And having concluded with our first oral argument of the morning, we now move on to the second oral argument. That case is A230360, Deborah Jane Clapp, appellant, versus Rochelle Cox in her official capacity as interim superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools et al. Respondents. And good morning, counsel. It looks like you are ready to go. A few notes before you begin with your arguments. As I know you know, appellant has 15 minutes, respondent has 15 minutes, and then appellant can make a five-minute rebuttal argument as well. The argument is being live streamed this morning and also audio recorded, and a recording of the argument will be available on our website shortly. I just ask that to enable others to figure out what's going on in this courtroom, you please introduce yourself and identify the party you are representing before you begin making your argument. And with that, we are ready to begin with counsel for appellant. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, Michael Bekesha on behalf of plaintiff appellant Deborah Clapp. We're here today on a review of a motion to dismiss. That is significant because at that stage, plaintiff only needs to allege certain facts. Ms. Clapp does not need to prove each fact at this stage. She only simply needs to allege them. You know, this is no different than a negligence claim where you have four elements. You have duty, breach, causation, and damages. And to survive a motion to dismiss, the plaintiff in that case needs to allege facts to satisfy each of those elements. Of course, as the legal proceedings continue, whether it's summary judgment or trial, the plaintiff may not be able to prove the negligence claim. Maybe can't prove the duty. Maybe can't prove the breach. But that is what takes place after a complaint and an answer is filed. At the motion to dismiss stage, all that's needed are the factual allegations.
For a taxpayer to assert that they have standing, what allegations are necessary in the complaint under Minnesota law?
Under Minnesota law, a cause of action under taxpayer standing. Taxpayer standing is a little bit of a misnomer because in Minnesota, unlike in federal court, it's not just the standing portion, it's also a cause of action.
I think we're familiar with the authorities. I'm just interested to hear from your perspective, what is the basic notice pleading requirement necessary for a taxpayer to assert standing?
Sure. It is to be a taxpayer, an expenditure of funds by the government, and those expenditure of funds are illegal. And so that is the...
So no actual harm?
The case law seems to suggest that the harm is the expenditure of taxpayer funds on an illegal purpose. So there is no individualized harm for that particular taxpayer. It's the harm in itself is the expenditure illegally by the government.
That's concerning to me, counsel, and I'll tell you why. If those are the only elements that are necessary for a taxpayer to assert standing, then I'm not sure there's anything that would prevent a taxpayer from challenging any appropriation by the legislature or a budget line item by a state agency, just saying, I'm a taxpayer, the government's spending money, and it's illegal. It strikes me that is far beyond what we have allowed in Minnesota to assert taxpayer standing. How do you reconcile that?
I don't think it is far beyond what is recognized in Minnesota. In Minnesota, the cases are clear when they talk about that there is no specific injury in fact that's needed, similar to other cases. What is needed is the taxpayer, the expenditure of the funds that the taxpayer is paying, and that those funds are being spent illegally. That's what the cases stand for.
Isn't sort of the underlying premise for taxpayer standing that the funds of the taxpayer are being diminished by some unlawful purpose, though? I mean, doesn't there have to be necessarily some showing that the monies are less than what they should be, you know, due to the illegality or alleged illegality.
Yes, Your Honor, but once money is spent, money has been diminished.
Okay, so how is in this case, how does the complaint establish a diminishment?
Money is being expended, Your Honor. Money is being expended to implement Article 15 of this contract.
Wouldn't money be expended either way, though, under the specific factual circumstances alleged here? In other words,
no, Your Honor.
If layoffs were happening in the sort of previous way that they happened, based on seniority alone, wouldn't funds necessarily be expended in that process? And how does the alleged illegality here, therefore, diminish the taxpayer funds?
Money would be spent, but it wouldn't be spent in a way that it cannot be spent. I mean, for example, if it weren't for this contract, money would not be spent in identifying which educators are of color. If this contract was not in effect, money would not be spent creating lists, asking educators how they identify, creating not only lists of, you know, who's white and who is of color, but also creating lists of who's going to be reinstated first, who's going to be laid off first.
Does your complaint allege that taxpayer money will be spent on such activities?
It does, Your Honor. Paragraphs 15, 16, and 17 of the complaint specifically identify the expenditure of funds.
Mr. Bekesha, can I follow up on both my esteemed colleagues' questions, because I'm not sure I fully understand your answer. Would you agree that if you simply alleged a disagreement with a policy, that would not create taxpayer standing?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Am I understanding, as you interpret the law and as I look at it, the key is the illegality of the spending?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Because the trial court here did also seem to focus on, well, this might actually save money because you'll have lesser qualified senior teachers who get paid at a different level. But I didn't understand the case law that would answer the question. Is the spending at all, whether it's the same, less, or more, illegal? And is that how you would interpret the case law and what you've alleged in the complaint for Rule 12 purposes?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think there are two cases from this court that are, you know, could be helpful. One is the Sayer case, in which this court found that the plaintiffs have standing, but then dismissed the case on summary judgment against the plaintiffs because the court found that the activity was not illegal, that it was lawful. So just because the activity ended up being lawful in the end, it didn't mean that there wasn't standing or that the taxpayer didn't have a claim. It's simply that the allegations at the end of the day couldn't survive. And that is, you know, typical process under Minnesota law when it comes to notice pleading.
And when you started your comments today, you said that is the cause of action, the taxpayer standing. So I hadn't heard it quite that way. So that's in part your answer to respondents' request in the alternative that we affirm the district court on the unresolved failure to state a claim. Your point being is once they're standing, and we haven't talked about ripeness, but assuming it's ripe, then that is the cause of action. So you have stated a claim. Your client has.
Yes, Your Honor. It's three elements. Whether you want to look at them as standing or the cause of action, it's a three-element claim. It's taxpayer being a taxpayer, spending of taxpayer money, and that money is being spent for an illegal purpose.
Is there a requirement also that the spending has to be a specific disbursement? I mean, when I look at McKee and Olson and Schroeder, those seem to suggest, or McKee, not Olson, McKee, Schroeder, and Citizens. Those three cases seem to suggest that it's not just any spending, but that there has to be a specific disbursement. And I'm wondering if that is part of the notice pleading requirement.
It's not, Your Honor. I think if you look at Citizens, the per diem wasn't, there wasn't an allegation that the increase in the per diem, that specific legislators were going to spend more than the original. It was simply that they changed the per diem. Therefore, the plaintiffs believed in the future, legislators may ask to be reimbursed under the higher per diem. And so there wasn't a specific line item because that may have not came to fruition. I think also if you look at another case from this court, Hayden, in that case, the taxpayers alleged that the city council had no authority to operate a park. In its allegations, in the complaint, the complaint in that case states, plaintiff seeks to enjoin the inclusion of any city appropriation of funds for construction, operation, and maintenance in the commons in violation of the city charter. That wasn't a specific line item, Your Honor. That was seeking to enjoin the inclusion of any city appropriations of funds for operation and maintenance of a park. That would include employees that probably would have been employed previously to maintain other buildings and other facilities. There was no allegation that, in that case, the city council was going to hire new people, expend new money to preserve, maintain, operate this park. It was simply any expenditure, any appropriation in the future. That is less specific of notice than we have here, Your Honor, in this court, found standing in that case. In fact, it also found that the charter, that the action there was illegal and continued to enjoin the city council from operating a park. And that is very similar to what we have here, Your Honor. It is simply the expenditure of funds for an illegal purpose that provides my client with the, not only the standing, but also the cause of action here. And we have specific factual allegations for each of those elements. And the court—
Isn't your challenge more to the manner of the use of the funds than to the purpose of the funds? In other words, the purpose of the spending is to reduce the workforce. And what you're complaining about is the manner of reducing the workforce, you know, in a way that allegedly violates equal protection.
Well, in this instance, the purpose of the expenditure of funds, the purpose is the contract. It's the MOU with the teachers' union, in which all parties, the superintendent, as well as the union, said, this is a model contract that we want the nation to look at. The superintendent said this was of importance to us, that this was a reason, you know, after a, I believe, 3-week strike, this was one of the most important terms of that MOU. And so the purpose of the expenditure, the purpose of creating a contract and for MPS to be spending money in the future was in part to implement Article 15, and that's what we are challenging. We're challenging the implementation, and because of the implementation, the expenditure of funds to implement it. Now, in the end, maybe MPS is right, and no money is being expended on it. That's a factual question that will be resolved after this stage. At this point, the allegations are clear. We have sufficient allegations, and they must be accepted as true. The trial court seemed to go out of its way to say, well, maybe this could happen, or maybe that could happen, or maybe something else would happen. That's all possible.
Can I just ask a practical, factual question? This agreement was set to expire in June of 2023. What's the status there?
The contract will continue to remain in effect until a new contract is signed and no contract has been signed.
All right, as would be the case with any collective bargaining agreement.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
thank
I believe our complaint sets out that, I think lays that out so that we don't have an issue there, that we are still alleging that that contract is in effect.
Okay, thank you.
What in a nutshell, one sentence with your last minute makes this ripe, even though there's no allegation that any teacher has been affected by that provision?
Because the process has been, the contract has been implemented or it has taken effect. It was a contract that was ratified by the teachers' union, signed off by the city, by the school board. The school is going through its process. Whether or not it has currently laid off or is in the process of laying off is a factual question. It doesn't also only apply to layoffs. It also applies to reinstatements. So to the extent that the news shows that Minneapolis Public Schools may have a shortage of teachers, they could most likely reinstate teachers, and this contract would apply, as well as reassignments from one school district to another. And we allege that these actions are taking place. If they're not taking place, that's something that would come out in discovery and would be appropriate for summary judgment or trial to resolve this case. But again, we have factual allegations, and they must be accepted true at this point in the game. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tim Sullivan with Ratwick, Rozak & Maloney. I'm here today on behalf of the respondents in this case, primarily Minneapolis Public Schools. With me today is Leah Tapu. He's the general counsel for the school district. May it please the court. This case is not really about the contract. This case is about fundamental issues of jurisdiction for the courts. This case is about what is required for a party to use up the time and resources of the judicial branch of the state of Minnesota. What needs to be alleged? And in law school, they have taught us that you need to have standing. Standing focuses on the issue of who is the person asserting the claim. Is this the right person to be in this courtroom asking for relief? There's also ripeness. Is this the right time for this party who has standing to be asserting this claim? Is there an actual judiciable controversy for which the court could redress? You know, is there an injury that can be fixed? And then also, is it the right claim? You know, do we have actual recognized causes of action that are being asserted in this case? You know, that way it opens up the body of case law that help the attorneys and the court determine whether or not that case has any merit, okay? You know, courts do not give advisory opinions. Courts do not allow strangers to a situation to come in and try to assert, you know, rights that they do not have. You know, I just hope it is worth, you know, mentioning here that the appellant in this case is not an employee of the school district. The appellant in this case is not a teacher in the school district. The appellant in this case has no rights under the collective bargaining agreement that was negotiated between the school district and the teachers union, which is the exclusive representative of the teachers.
But isn't it true, Mr. Sullivan, that's not the basis that they're alleging? It's obviously taxpayer status. And so isn't it true that there's a plethora of decisions from our Supreme Court that, number one, favor preventative actions like a declaratory judgment action, and that when it's obvious, and we're just looking at Rule 12, so there's an allegation of a provision in a contract, which on its face and as alleged would be an equal protection violation, what is advisory about that? It's real, it's there, and I think it was the Supreme Court's 1954 decision involving Minneapolis School District where that same claim was made, and the Supreme Court said, well, obviously, you don't need to wait till the status quo is broken to be ripe because we've got all the facts alleged. Why doesn't that just answer the question here for us?
Well, that's a good question, and I think that the questioning that was presented to the appellant sort of brought up the right question for us to discuss at this point in time. The notion of taxpayer standing is that, yes, a taxpayer under very limited circumstances as set forth in McKee, which has been very closely limited to its facts, actually expressly limited to its facts by recent decisions of this court as recently as 2020, you know, under the taxing and spending power of the government, okay, when there is an illegal action that diminishes the taxpayer funds, the courts have found that that could open up taxpayer standing. You know, the general rule is that a claimant needs to have an actual injury in fact. That's even the general rule for taxpayer standing, that generally a taxpayer to sue about whatever they want would need to show how they are more negatively impacted by an action of government than the average taxpayer would be.
So if I just point you to paragraph 17 of the complaint in this case, that paragraph says, while you're digging for it, I'll just read it. For defendant to lay off or reassign teachers, defendant MPS must undertake a comprehensive process which includes identifying all teachers employed at the schools where layoffs or reassignments are to occur, identifying positions to which teachers may be reassigned, several rounds of employment interviews for those reassigned positions, reference checks of teachers to be reassigned in an appeal process which includes mediation. Each step will cost defendants public money. Why is that not sufficient to show diminishment of taxpayer funds for the purpose, at least, of a Rule 12 analysis?
So two-part answer to that question. So first of all, under Rule 12, while it is true that the court has to take factual allegations as true, they are not entitled to deference on any legal conclusions. Okay, so the legal issue that we're looking at here is what does the idea of specific disbursement or a spending of funds that is illegal. Both of those functions matter. That was acknowledged by appellant's counsel saying that he says that there's a cause of action. Well, I think it's just the standing analysis. I'm a taxpayer. There is a disbursement of funds, and that disbursement is illegal. The question that you raised regarding the manner of spending versus the spending itself is informative to the question that you just answered. The manner of spending is a policy decision. You know, government is always going to spend money. Everything that government does that is done by employees that are working for the government is going to cost money. If that was the only thing that was required for a mere taxpayer to have standing to challenge it, it would blow the notion of standing out of the water. There would not be an end to it.
So what else? So, I mean, just sort of to back it up, counsel says there's three elements to a taxpayer standing action. The plaintiff has to be a taxpayer. There has to be an expenditure of public funds by the government, and the expenditure has to be illegal. Is there some other required element that must be alleged in the complaint in order to withstand a Rule 12 motion for a taxpayer standing case?
They have not asserted those required elements. You know, when you think about those elements, there needs to be an actual expenditure of funds. Okay, we're looking at the taxing and spending power of government.
Well, or about to be. In other words,
ripeness,
is
sure.
That,
so,
and the paragraph that Judge Gaitis just read, it alleges that.
So, alleging that something is illegal is a legal conclusion. Okay, alleging that something violates the Establishment Clause of the Constitution is a legal conclusion. And I, you know, our briefing addresses the Establishment Clause.
Get to the merits, though? That's got kind of the focus of our questions today. They've alleged an equal protection violation, and the expenditure of funds seems to be conceded. You have to expend funds to do what, to implement that article.
But both of those have to be in tandem. The expenditure itself needs to be unlawful, okay? When you look at McKee, the argument was that money was being spent to fund abortions. But the illegality was that this money did not properly go through the channels for spending it, okay? There are cases in there about purchasing or building a highway, okay? Building a highway, but the process did not go through the municipal bidding. The project did not properly go through the municipal bidding process. They are challenging the legality of the spending itself. Now, in this case, even if you assume that school district employees negotiating and administering a contract constitute the type of disbursement that would meet one of the factors, you have to look at, does that expenditure itself, is it illegal? You know, is it illegal?
So what you're saying is nothing in paragraph 17 is in itself something that wouldn't happen absent in illegality.
Well, absolutely. You know, we have an obligation to meet and negotiate with the exclusive representative of our teachers. We are expending money to sit at the table and to negotiate. It is a hard enough process to negotiate a collective bargaining agreement in any school district without, you know, the taxpayer. Ms. Clapp was not at the table. You know, she was not, you know, she is not a party to this contract. We have an obligation to spend that money. There's nothing illegal about negotiating
Mr.
a CBA.
Sullivan, it's alleged that the expenditure of money, the discharge or accessing, an interesting phrase, of teachers will be based on the race. The allegations say that. I realize the provision doesn't, but there's provision that's exactly what the superintendent said it was, as well as the president. So my question is, isn't that sufficient to allege an illegality? Or to say a different way, if that same provision said that the teachers will be based on based not on seniority, but by those who are overrepresented as opposed to underrepresented, wouldn't that on its face allege an equal protection claim sufficient to withstand Rule 12?
No, I do not believe that would be the case, Your Honor, and this is why, because it goes to the spending itself needs to be illegal, not the policy goals that are being implemented by that spending. The case, the Hayden case he brought up, which involved Minneapolis trying to build a park, okay? The city of Minneapolis was trying to expend funds to build the park that is outside of the brand new stadium. And the challenge was, you do not have the authority to operate a park. Any amount of money that you spend to operate a park is illegal because you do not have the right to operate a park.
Well,
that's not what Ms.
Let me pose a question differently. Would you agree or concede that spending money in violation of the Equal Protection Clause is illegal?
I would not concede that spending money that is later to be determined to be, because I don't think the spending of money itself is what violates the Equal Protection Clause, Your Honor. I think that if there is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause, that is obviously illegal, okay? But that also brings me to the statement of a claim that there is no private cause of action to enforce the Minnesota State Constitution.
Before you get there, counsel, I know you got a little waylaid through no fault of your own. Can we just get back to my original question of the appellant identified three elements to a taxpayer standing claim.
Yes.
Are you in agreement that those are the three elements, or is there an additional element that needs to be pled to satisfy a notice pleading requirement?
I agree that those are the elements that the courts have applied, but the way that they have applied those elements is that you have to establish all of them and that they work in tandem, particularly when you talk about an actual expenditure of funds and that expenditure itself is illegal. You know, as the Hayden case, the park case, spending any money on a park is illegal. If a taxpayer saw that they were trying to build a playground that was not ADA accessible, and they said, I want to challenge this case because you spending this money would violate the ADA, therefore it's illegal. That is not what the question is. Is the expenditure of funds itself illegal? And in this case, what is being alleged is that the school district is spending money to negotiate a collective bargaining agreement, and in particular, it is spending money to negotiate layoff terms of a collective bargaining agreement, which is a mandatory subject of bargaining under PELRA. It is not something that the school district has any discretion to sit at the table and to negotiate. They are focusing on the manner in which the negotiation happened. They are concerned about how the contract turned out, but they cannot claim that the negotiation of that contract itself, the expenditure of funds to negotiate a CBA, to negotiate mandatory terms in a CBA, is unlawful. And that is where the taxpayer, with no other...
What if that's the holdout provision? What if all the other terms of the collective bargaining agreement are agreed upon except this provision? And then everybody's sitting around the table solely to talk about this provision and negotiate this provision. Then do we have an equal protection violation?
No, Your Honor.
At least a claim.
I do not believe that we do, because we still are, while we are negotiating and spending money negotiating, we are still not spending money illegally. We are spending money in a manner which we are required to do by law. We are required to meet and negotiate with our with exclusive representative of our teachers.
So, in other words, I guess it's sort of the opposite of this concept of diminishment. There has to be, according to your argument, an extra expense, and that extra expense has to be illegal?
Well, the cases talk about how a taxpayer to have standing, their whole argument is that my money is being diminished for an illegal reason. So I think that's where the district court came in saying that, you know, if we look at this, not even on its face, will it cost the money? It could save money. There are other cases. There was the case that involved an unallotment of funds, you know, and then in that case, they challenged, well, you can't do that. The governor was able to unallot. And they looked at that and they said, that's not illegal. And in fact, that would actually save money. There's other case that involved tax benefits. I think it was might have been the Rukumina case that involved, you know, tax cuts, tax incentives. And in that case, they said there's not an actual expenditure of funds here. They're actually, you know, not taxing other people. You know, the argument was getting, it's sort of similar to what we're facing here, where the taxpayer says, well, if they're not allowing that person to pay taxes, presumably my taxes are going to go up. You know, and they said that is not sufficient because you are not asserting a specific disbursement of funds. And I think I agreed, Your Honor, that the cases that do focus on it do require a specific disbursement because that helps us look at are we really allowing this to happen? Are we really allowing a mere taxpayer with the only interest that a portion of their property taxes goes to the school district to have a heckler's veto over a specific term in the collective bargaining agreement? You know, we don't have a teacher, an employee of the school district here saying, I have rights under the contract and I have concerns. That's a completely different case. That's not this case. So,
So kind of just to tie it back to my original question, I'm kind of interested in this question, as you might guess.
Yes.
You think that in order to satisfy the notice pleading requirement, there has to be some allegation that a specific disbursement of government funds is directed towards the illegal activity.
I think there needs to be a specific allegation that the expenditure of funds itself is illegal. You do not have the power to do this. You don't have the power to spend this money. It's not you don't have power to spend money in this way. No one can seriously argue that government does not have the power to spend money. There is a taxing and spending power of government that is enshrined in the Constitution. We have a whole process to decide how that money is to be spent on policy matters. That's called the legislative process, the electoral process. We send people up there to make policy decisions. There are multiple cases that say the mere disagreement over a policy decision, i.e. how funds are otherwise legally spent, is not something that opens the door to Minnesota courts for a taxpayer to stand. Okay? That is why when I look at the elements of, I'm out of time, but can I finish just this one?
Go ahead and finish your comment.
That is why the elements of taxpayer standing, which is not a separate cause of action, and I defer my briefing on that, is that they all work together. You have to have an actual disbursement of funds, and that spending itself needs to be illegal. We don't have that here because either there was no disbursement of funds as intended by the court by merely having state employees doing work, okay? But even if you were to buy the notion that that is an expenditure, every bit of work that they did in negotiating and implementing a contract, that spending itself is illegal. She just disagrees how it's happening, which is not her place, respectfully. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I think I just want to clarify, we're not challenging money being spent on the negotiation, which is what I heard my colleague talk a lot about. We're challenging the expenditure of funds of implementing what was negotiating. Whether or not people sat around the table and talked about this and agreed on something, sure, money was spent then. But that's not what this complaint challenges. That's not what this case is about. This case is about the expenditure of money to implement Article 15, which we have alleged violates the Minnesota's Equal Protection Guarantee. Council talked about building highways and how there was a taxpayer claim survived because there was a building a highway that didn't go through the proper process. And he said, well, we got to look at the fact that it was the actual money that was being spent, not the purpose. Well, the highway was going to be spent, was going to be built. The money was going to be spent. It just didn't go through the proper process. And so there may have not been a diminishment of funds after it went through the actual process and a new contractor was hired. So the cases don't necessarily talk specifically about diminishment of funds. They talk about the expenditure of funds. For example, a recent case the Hayden case in 2020, going back to one of the first questions I think I had this morning about, you know, damage and injury and, you know, does it have to be specific? In that case specifically, this court said, relying on McKee, even without damage or injury, however, a taxpayer may still have standing if the action challenges unlawful disbursements of public money or illegal action on the part of public officials. So there doesn't need to be this, you know, very specific injury in fact that the other cases talk about. This is, you know, kind of a unique beast. But also, I just want to say it's not unusual. Roughly 43 states around the country have taxpayer claims, have taxpayer actions. It's very different than federal court because of the lack of, you know, Article III requirements. And so this is not unusual. You know, the government, of course, doesn't want citizens to be able to come in and say what they're doing is illegal and stopping them. Government wants to be able to do what it wants when it wants to. But this is a protection for citizens. You know, this isn't here because it's a policy disagreement. It's not because my client is unhappy with how the contract turned out. My client is concerned that government money is being spent to violate the equal protection guarantee of the Minnesota Constitution. We have alleged that she's a taxpayer, that money's being spent, and that money is being spent illegal, not just that she doesn't like what's going on. And so for, you know, the government to stand up here and talk about the slippery slope and how this is going to cause all sorts of problems down the road, well, this has existed in Minnesota for over 100 years, and we haven't had that problem. So I'm not sure why it's going to start today after this case, after a motion to dismiss that we think should have been denied because we have specific allegations, and at this point, those allegations must be accepted as true. I had one other point I wanted to make, just to highlight this idea of allegations. The Sawyer case from 2009 in this court, you know, the court there said because appellants alleged the Minnesota Department of Transportation illegally spent money in awarding the bridge contract, we conclude that appellant standing as taxpayers in the state is sufficient to bring this action. Again, it's an allegation. We're on a motion to dismiss. My client, in paragraphs, I apologize, Your Honors. Paragraph 1 in 15 identified that she is a taxpayer spending, that is paying taxes, that those taxes are going to Minneapolis Public Schools, that Minneapolis Public Schools are expending funds, that's paragraphs 16 and 17, and that the expenditure of funds are going for an illegal purpose or to an illegal activity, that they're being spent illegally. That's paragraphs 8, 9, 11, 12, and 13. And of course, whether or not the spending is illegal, the action is illegal, is a legal question. Similarly, if you look at a negligence claim, whether or not there's a duty, that oftentimes falls on a legal question. But just because the illegality is a legal question doesn't mean that it needs to be proved at this point. All it means is that we need to allege that it's illegal, allege that the spending is illegal, and allege that she's a taxpayer, and we have done that. I see my time is up. If there are no other questions, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. The case was very well argued, and it is now submitted to us. We will issue our decision within the next 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honors.